the day that I made the complaint to the FDA, a few hours later, I was fired under the pretext that I was not a good fit. I'm 100% confident that I was not a good fit because I was refusing to be complicit in their fraud.
Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. Now, you may have heard, if watching independent media, that recently a regional director who was employed at the research organization Ventavia Research Group told the British Medical Journal that the company falsified data, unblinded patients, employed inadequately trained vaccinators, and was slow to follow up on adverse events reported in Pfizer's phase 3 trial of its COVID-19 injection. Staff who conducted quality control checks were reportedly overwhelmed by the volume of problems that they were finding. And after repeatedly notifying Ventavia of these problems, the regional director, Brooke Jackson, emailed a complaint to the FDA. Ventavia fired her that same day. Now, had you been watching corporate media, you likely know nothing of this monumentally important and relevant story, or at the very least, you've been told it was debunked and to move past it. Yet Jackson has provided the British Medical Journal with dozens of internal company documents, photos, audio recordings, and emails, all of which she shared with me, much of which we'll share with you today. All of this will prove to you not only that you are being collectively and willfully lied to by Ventavia, by the mainstream media, by the FDA, Pfizer, but that there is a concerted effort to hide this information from your view. So joining me today is Brooke Jackson to discuss all of this information and what it really shows you around one of the most important things that's happened in our society in living memory. Thank you for joining me today, Brooke Jackson. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. I think it's very brave what you are doing, and I think this is an incredibly important conversation that needs to make it out to the masses. So I think what's important to start with is your background here. I think my audience is very, very familiar with the story from the November 2nd when this began in the British Medical Journal and what has followed up since. I think it's important for people to hear your side of this and the information that you have to back this stuff up. So let's start, first of all, with your background before Ventavia and then leading into when you got hired on September 7th to Ventavia.
Sure, sure. So I have been in the clinical research industry for almost 20 years now. I started as a clinical research coordinator, did that for many years. I have a certification as a clinical research coordinator that I received through the Academy of Clinical Research Professionals, moved my way through to be a clinical trial manager, a director of operations, and then as a regional director with Ventavia.
And so this is clearly, I mean, the point to make here in the beginning is to make it clear that this is her background for this position is completely adequate, and the reason she was hired is because of that fact. So she gets hired at Ventavia to specifically investigate quality control and to make sure that these things are up to snuff, essentially, right? And this is one of the main points of that job, correct?
That's right, yes.
Okay.
So I also have a certification as a clinical trial auditor that I received. So, right, my job in going into Ventavia was basically to manage the day-to-day operations of the study, specifically the Pfizer clinical trial, the COVID trial, the protocol numbers C459-1001. And I started that back in September of 2020.
Well, and one of the interesting parts of this whole discussion is when this came out on the British Medical Journal discussing all the things that we laid out in the beginning there, is that it was very, very obvious that none in the mainstream corporate media wanted to touch this story. And immediately there was efforts to undermine what you were saying and whether you even worked there. So let's start with that information in regard to what, you know, the verification of you actually working at this location. So can you go ahead and let us know what we're looking at here first?
Let me make my screen a little bit bigger here.
for those watching right now, you can see that this is the delegation sign-in sheet, which goes on for 23 pages. I'll focus just on this one where you can see Brooke Jackson's name written right there.
Yeah, so this is what we would consider what we call a delegation of authority log. This is basically a sheet that goes into a regulatory binder that identifies all of the staff that are authorized by the principal investigator of the trial. And for this specific document, the principal investigator is Dr. Cook. But he basically delegates the tasks that each individual is allowed to do as part of the study.
Right. And so what's important to understand here is that despite the evidence being clear that she definitely works at this location, was involved with these trials specifically, that this is something that was denied right out of the gate, which I think is really interesting. On top of that, here is your letter directly from Ventavia discussing this. It's, so why would they, in your mind, deny that you work there right out of the gate? I find that to be almost laughably ridiculous.
I think it's ridiculous as well. And to answer your question, I think that we have to ask Ventavia why they would be, you know, mistruthful about my assignment and my duties. I really don't know. It's mind-boggling. Why they would just blatantly lie about what I did there.
And this is something that the British Medical Journal and Thacker himself has followed up with and verified as well. And this is all public information that's easily out there. So I tend to think it's obviously because of what happened and what this is now beginning to show us. So let's step into what you saw. So September 7th, 2020 is when you're hired. Now, very quickly, you began to see problems during this trial, right? So why don't you walk us through what the first thing that you saw was and the evolution of that understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I started September 7th, which was a holiday. So I wasn't actually on site until the 8th of September. And I started at the Fort Worth, Texas location and immediately recognized, you know, what I would call just chaotic, very busy clinic, very limited staff. The first thing that I noticed was a clinical research coordinator who I was shadowing just to see, you know, the clinic flow and how they ran their day-to-day operations. So I was shadowing this clinical research coordinator and I walked into a patient room with her with, you know, the patient's permission, of course, and watched her, I guess, initiate the process of informed consent. And as I'm watching her do this, she was just going very quickly. You know, the consent form was 20 plus pages. I can't remember exactly, but it was a long informed consent form and it wasn't a complicated study, but it was, you know, we're talking about a novel virus and a novel vaccine. So I just didn't feel like she was taking the time to really explain what the study involved, the, you know, applications that were to be used during the study. For example, the electronic diary, that's, you know, if you've never participated in a study or used a device to capture, you know, symptoms, et cetera, it's not something that you can just breeze through. So that was really the first thing that I saw. It wasn't an informed consent in my mind because she didn't fully go through that. It was just quickly, here's the study, you want to do this, here's where you sign, here's where you date, where, you know, the informed consent is a process. It's not just a moment in time when you sign and date something.
I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because it's one of the key points that I've been bringing up from the beginning of this that hasn't been met. Even plenty of peer-reviewed science has brought up the idea of even something like antibody-dependent enhancement and saying that we're not meeting informed consent because people aren't being informed about this.
Correct.
So it's important to cite again that, you know, you as the regional director, one of the key points is quality control. And so you noticing a problem like this is exactly what you should be doing. So what you know, so continue, please. I just want to make sure people heard that because that's an important part of this. And in every discussion around this vaccine, I have not seen informed consent being met, in my personal opinion, and now backed up by you know, Brooke Jackson herself from this location. So please continue.
Yeah. And looking back, when I did send the FDA the emailed complaint, the informed consent wasn't one of the things that was on my mind at the time when I wrote that. I think I listed, you know, 14 different I guess, concerns that I had, but informed consent wasn't one of those. But looking back, absolutely, you know, when I was quality controlling documents for this study, there were often times that signatures were missing, dates were missing. You could tell that in different parts of the informed consent where signature from the patient was required, that they were mismatched. And in my training and in my experience, that usually meant that there was some sort of forgery involved. So I'm confident that that happened. But back to what I was saying, I didn't list that in the initial complaint that I made to the FDA, but it was certainly something that was brought up to what we'll talk about in the leadership team, I guess, later on in the interview.
Yeah. But well, yeah, I mean, so, oh, go ahead. Please continue.
Oh, that's okay. But yeah, so that was the first thing I noticed, in improper informed consent. You know, I kind of stepped in and went over things that I felt that should have been discussed with the patient at that moment. And so that particular patient was taken care of and properly informed once I stepped in.
Oh, good. Yeah, the informed consent part of it, you can understand why that would take a backseat to the other things that you were seeing. And you know, we'll get into the documentation that backs up the things that she just said in general. But let's start with this one, because I think this was one of the ones that you sent me that really caught my eye. And it's something that Paul Thacker has already posted on his article as well. And oh, by the way, his article, as well as the other coverage of this, will be included in the show notes. If you can let us know what we're looking at here, this is from action items from August 11th. So what we're looking at here is where it says talk to Nika or talk to Dana. And underneath them, one of the notation points is falsifying data. And that's in regard to their e-diary. So I guess explain for us what an e-diary is in the context of these workers, what their jobs are, and then what they're basically saying. Are they falsifying data? Is that something they're looking out for? Just give us that explanation.
So I'll tell you. So like I was saying, every morning we would have, you know, a call to kind of discuss our top things on the to-do list. And that was a running document. There's a couple of them because of the way that the emails were sent. Sometimes this document wasn't attached, so it would just be in an email. But this was an actual Word document that was attached to an email that I was looped in on.
The key point here is that this goes back to a time before you got here that establishes quite clearly that they, as a leadership team, were very aware that this is something that was at least happening to some degree. So I think the argument right out of the gate that what you found was just completely unfounded is ridiculous. That's what Paul is basically arguing in that most recent article, is this: there's no way to look at this and walk away thinking that what you said is unfounded.
Right. So Paul, and you know, when I took the initial steps in contacting the British Medical Journal, because I was never have been a political person, but I saw very quickly in watching television and just the, you know, news stations, that it was so different when you turned on the TV to one station and then another. Maybe the stories were so different, and I knew that I had to get my information to somebody of scientific mind, you know, and I trusted the British Medical Journal. They're one of the oldest, most respected, in my opinion, scientific journals. And so that's really the reason that I sought out the BMJ, and from there, you know, met Paul Thacker. But it is obvious, like you mentioned, you know, from that document before, the problems, the misconduct, and I'll say it because I'm this confident, the fraud that Ventavia is doing, continues to do to this day. It's not just my story. This is a story for everybody. Clinical trials are important. They're what we base a lot of things on. And I've felt very privileged to be, you know, in the position that I've been in, to watch devices and medicines and vaccines go from the clinical trial phase to treatments and therapies that we use as standard of care today. It's been an honor to be able to be a part of that. And in all of my years, Ryan, I have never seen this. And it makes me so sad that these people that are volunteering their selves to science, basically, are not being cared for. Their safety doesn't matter. It's all about Ventavia and their profit.
It's just heartbreaking to realize this. You know, it's sort of like a finding out there's no Santa Claus moment when you realize that these people aren't actually what they have pretended they are. And that doesn't have to mean that everybody everywhere is like that, but it just begins to show you that there is sort of an illusion that we tell ourselves about certain positions of authority in society today. Now, since you brought this up, I just want to say that in general, I agree that I think going to somewhere like the British Medical Journal was the smartest thing you could have done in regard to how this went first. But on top of that, it's staggering to me that it went that zero mainstream media covered this after that happened. And on top of that, they went out of their way to try to dismiss it, acting like there was no evidence, except that this is the British Medical Journal that did their due diligence, that made it very clear that they spent months vetting the story. And it's just incredible that their first answer would be to go, well, we don't see anything there, so we're going to assume that it's not real. It's very intentionally deceptive. But I wanted to add, since you pointed this out, that there are two, in fact, former Ventavi employees that spoke with the British Medical Journal after Jackson, Brooke Jackson here, both confirmed broad aspects of Jackson's complaint, right? And still this continues to be dismissed. That's just absolutely outrageous to me. But bringing this back to the point we were on in regard to the falsifying data. So let's flesh that a little bit more in regard to what that showed you and what that suggests to where we go forward.
Yeah. So in reading, you know, earlier on, you know, the problems that I found were problems that were existing before I came. So the document that you're looking at is kind of just the leadership team's to-do list. Going back to, you know, what is that, August of 2020, falsifying data. These are some of the employees. Sorry, go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, no. So I was just adding multiple people. And it's not just one individual. It's listing off, at least on this one page, three different people that have to go over the fact that they have an issue of falsifying data. That just blows my mind. Right. And of course, this would be something that they would not want anybody to see. This is an internal conversation, right?
Sure. Yes, it is. It is an internal conversation. And I would like to also point out that, you know, Ventavia was conducting the COVID vaccine study in three different locations, and two of which, you know, I was the regional director and overseeing those operations for. The names that were listed a few moments ago, those are at different locations. So it's not just one site. It's three different sites. It's three different principal investigators. It's, you know, three sets of staff that are having issues.
Great point to bring up right there. And this is something that a lot of the other research has shown as well, is that this is not an isolated issue. That's the big point here, is this is a large sweeping issue that seems to, at the very least, encompass Ventavia. But I think it goes much larger than that. Regardless, go ahead.
I'm sorry. And that's kind of, you know, I think a lot of the people that are familiar with the story have misunderstood, I guess, where I'm coming from. In terms of, you know, conspiracy theorists and being an anti-vaxxer, that's not why I took my information to my managers, first of all, or to Pfizer, second, and then to the FDA, and then to the British Medical Journal. You know, it's just frustrating that, you know, you can't even bring up issues in a clinical trial without it being taken as, you know, conspiracy or, you know, I'm an anti-vaxxer. This is important for everybody. And it's so widespread within Ventavia. And it's not just with this COVID-19 vaccine. They are participating in other studies, in the maternal COVID study. They are participating in RSV trials, in our children and adults and seniors. And it's just my call is for more clinical trial oversight and accountability. Right. And so that's why I came forward, and that's why I have put myself in this very peculiar situation. You know, I'm not used to, you know, being the topic of really these types of conversation, because I feel a little out of my element. I'm not political. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. Well, I guess I am now based on the recent, definition change.
Good point. That's
fine. But I am, you know, so everybody knows I'm not afraid to say, I don't, you know, this isn't something I would usually like put out there, but, you know, I've been doubly vaccinated. My children are vaccinated. They're up to date on all their childhood immunizations. We typically get our flu shots. I'm not against the vaccine. I think it's appropriate in certain patient populations. So that is not, and I want to make that very clear to the audience, you know, I'm not for or really against anything. I'm calling for more clinical trial oversight because this is, it's some pretty terrible things.
Yeah.
And like I was telling Ryan today, you know, it's not just me, it's two other Ventavia employees. I've come to find, you know, in the last couple of days that even more, there's been some leaked documents from as recent as this month. So I'm happy that people are finding, I guess, the courage. I don't know. I hear it all the time. You're so brave. And thank you so much for coming forward and bringing this story to light, but I'm just doing my job. While I appreciate, you know, I appreciate everybody and their positive comments.
Well, it starts with one person, and hopefully, and you know what, you should feel that your actions have given other people the courage to come out as well. And I hope we see a waterfall of more of this coming out. And I believe we will. That it's important to understand. But what you touched on there is really important in regard to what does this do to actual accountability? Right. So the argument is that this is unfounded, but this wasn't even engaged with before that was the case. Right. It was reflexively dismissed. And this is what was covered early on. So what does this ultimately do? It creates a twofold kind of situation where one, it de-incentivizes people from reporting anything because they see how that's going to go. And then it also hides potential problems, you know, and this does not speak even remotely to the agenda or the direction of actual safety. You know, it really is the antithesis of what they pretend they're doing.
Right.
Now, I want to point out the next article, the next document we have in front of us here, where it jumps into where she is now present, the week she's been here, and it continues past that. So we're establishing that long before there were issues that they were already pointing out that needed to be corrected. Now we go to September 14th. Where we have an internal document that points out again, general findings, staff moving, staff moving too quickly, sloppy documentation, not documenting appropriately. Now that seems to exactly line up with what we just saw from before she got there. So now you're there, you got there early on the 7th going forward and you begin to see these things early. So this document seems to back up exactly what you were seeing. Am I incorrect in thinking that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've been asked, you know, 100 times, why do you think that this was happening? What was going on that would cause this many problems? And it was speed. It was a rush to enroll as many patients as they could as quickly as possible. And that was, you know, partly on Ventavia. But as I, you know, read through my emails and sat in on meetings and a lot of it was Pfizer. Pfizer's push to enroll more. How many more can you get? You know, really pushing for, you know, patients that fit into a certain demographic, minorities, our healthcare workers, our first responders. Not that they should be treated any differently, but these are people that are, you know, they're important, yes, but I just felt like in some instances they were being targeted, you know, for their participation. And it, like you said, as the days kind of moved forward and I was able to really dig in and look at patients' charts and compare information, I was seeing exactly what was documented even before I came, but on a think bigger scale, because, you know, this was rapid enrollment, lots of people. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think wasn't fully understood in the British Medical Journal publication, because at the time when the FDA report was made, there were only approximately 1,000 patients that were consented. The day that I made the complaint to the FDA, a few hours later, I was fired under the pretext that I was not a good fit. And I'm 100% confident that I was not a good fit because I was refusing to be complicit in their fraud.
That's an absolutely fair statement backed up by the data. I mean, that's important to make sure is clear. I mean, why don't we look at the one that we've shown that lists off the problems going forward and talking about what you saw here. So this is the one that discusses the list that you gave them in regard to all the problems you saw. You want to discuss this for a moment?
I want to go back just a little bit, Ryan. So from the eighth forward, you know, I'm digging in, I'm looking through each of these subject charts, and I'm just finding so many problems from the unblinding of the subjects. Ventavia was printing off the randomization scheme and the confirmation of that randomization and putting and placing that those two documents or two separate documents and putting those into every participant's chart. And I've been asked a lot, why is that important? Blinding in clinical trials is essential. It was essential to this particular study. It takes out the potential for bias. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, one of the things that I saw and reported on, and they were not even aware that the two documents, or one of the documents rather, actually contained unblinding information. So that was one of the things. I was being copied on emails from ICON, which was the clinical research organization, about missing lab specimens, mislabeled lab specimens. And when I had the opportunity to go into our lab, we were not following our own standard operating procedures and, you know, cleaning the lab supplies, making sure, you know, that things were just on the up and up. And when I looked at the laboratory log, I could immediately recognize that there was information that was being captured or data that was being captured that just was not accurate. I mean, it's, we'll go through that document soon. Well, so from here, so this was on the 16th of the 16th of September, and I stayed late in clinic this one evening and went to the different areas within the clinic, the lab, the storage area where we kept the vaccine, refrigerators, et cetera. And immediately what I saw was, you know, the biohazard bag. And that's kind of been criticized a little bit from the BMJ article and people saying, well, what's the big deal about a Sharps container or, you know, a biohazard bag sitting, you know, just in the lab? And the reason that this is important, and I really want to point this out, is that, you know, the clinic was so busy, and, you know, they were trying to move the patients out of the rooms so that they could bring the next participant in. Mm-hmm. After they were vaccinated, they were placed wherever we could find, and I don't want to say we, they were placing them, you know, in the clinic wherever there was space. And one of the chairs where there was space was in the laboratory next to this biohazard bag. So, you know, one, my staff's safety, you know, and having a used needle just in a plastic bag is important to me. And, you know, patients as well. The patients were sat right next to this bag. And when I walked by it and I saw these used Sharp just, you know, in a plastic bag sitting there, it made me angry.
Well, that's not procedure, right? I mean, that's not the appropriate procedure.
No, not for Sharps. There is
right. which I think the reason, and it's an obvious one, why that should be relevant is because it simply speaks to the fact that they're not following standard operating procedure when it comes to safety. And the reason that's there, or that there is a procedure, is because those things are dangerous. So it just kind of broadly speaks to not following procedure, which suggests that there's a lot of other things that are concerning, and then that gets backed up by everything else you're showing. So it's right. It's almost dishonest to dismiss a point like that, in my opinion.
So this was on the 16th of September that I took these pictures, and I took them, you know, it was what, my eighth day on the job. And I just wanted to be able to take these pictures and show other members of my leadership team that, oh my gosh, this is what I found in the clinic this evening.
Which is also a very common thing. I wanted to point that out as well, is that that's also trying to be framed as somehow malicious. But anybody in a position where you're working somewhere, these things, you know, that might not be there in 5 minutes, right? The point is to show your supervisor that's not okay, and we need to make sure we correct this, as opposed to framing it as some kind of like malicious act, which is subjective at the very least, yet that's how it's being framed. So please continue.
Right. So once I left, I took a picture of the biohazard bag with the sharps in there. And then I went to our, I guess, I don't even know what they call it. It was just another room where they prepped the vaccine. And the picture on the right is a small plastic caddy that has vaccine boxes in it. And on the vaccine box itself were subject identification numbers. So if you looked at, for instance, we can say the principal investigator walks in and he sees this box with the subject number on there, he would know, or she would know, that this particular participant received the vaccine or they received the placebo, which goes back to, you know, integrity of data.
That's a very important one. Like, maybe speak for a moment on the importance of blinding and unblinding in regard to how these trials work.
Yeah. So for this particular study, I would just give an example. If the principal investigator knew that the participant received a vaccine, and then it was determined that there was an illness after vaccination, that principal investigator or sub investigator may you know, come to the conclusion that, oh, well, this participant received placebo vaccine, and it's unlikely that they would need to be tested for COVID.
It changes the actions they might take in regard to the study, which then very clearly undermines the efficacy of the data, which is why they do it, right? So, and again, whether this feels to you as a minor point, it speaks undeniably to a lack of procedure, a lack of following the procedures that are there for the very purpose of conducting this the way that they can then be used to influence actions, or so they say. This is not how it's supposed to go. No matter how you look at this, the data should be taken into question, in my opinion.
Mine too, right? It speaks to the overall integrity of the data, period.
Right.
So that evening, those two pictures were taken, and I, on my drive home that night, you know, I was thinking about just everything that I'd seen, not taking care of the participants in terms of monitoring them for safety after they were vaccinated. They were just put anywhere with no medical supervision. We were not following our standard operating procedures in terms of emergency, you know, management in the event that there was a reaction. A lot of times the investigator would come in for just a little bit of time and then he would leave. So, you know, the inclusion exclusion criteria, the eligibility wasn't being, you know, signed off. These, and I use the term loosely because the clinical research coordinators, the vaccinators that were put into these positions were not qualified to be put into those positions. You know, at the Fort Worth site specifically, the unblinded vaccinator was a receptionist who had, you know, when I looked at her CV, been a volunteer at, I can't remember where, but volunteered her time and worked at a taco restaurant and then came to Ventavia as a receptionist, and within a very short period of time was vaccinating these patients. So it was very, very disturbing what I was seeing. You know, when it was determined that the randomization and confirmation pages were unblinding potentially every single subject, and this was across all three of the sites, I made the decision that on the 16th, that the next day I was going to recommend that we immediately stop enrolling people into this study until we were able to recognize what we were doing and correct it and notify ICON and notify Pfizer, because per the protocol, anybody that was unblinded, and I was at that point because I'd seen what was left in the lab, they were to immediately be notified of unblinding. And so that was my recommendation. That next morning on the 17th, when we had our leadership call, I recommended that we immediately pause or stop enrollment until we could understand where we were with the study.
Yeah, figure out the full breadth of the problem. I want to ask you quickly about the hallway part of this. So the fact that these people are being, could you actually just speak for me a little bit more on the adverse events and the follow-up in regard to the timing and people being left in the hallways with potential adverse events that aren't being monitored and so on, and how, what that leads to?
Well, so once the participant receives their vaccination, per the protocol, we're to monitor them for at least 30 minutes. And in order for Ventavia to bring in more patients, we only had 5 exam rooms. And at some points during even when I was there, there were only 4, you know, sometimes 5, I think, coordinators that were there to handle all of these participants. And they're just, it was chaotic, you know, trying to manage all these participants and take care of them, you know, like they should have been taken care of. No management, no leadership there. The principal investigator not there. But so for 30 minutes being monitored, everybody was just placed in, you know, wherever they could be sat.
So it doesn't sound like it's a situation where they can fully monitor the problems, which, by the way, are one of the focal points of why they're doing this, is to monitor the follow-up and the safety. And it doesn't seem like that's even the focal point, at least from my perspective. Is that an incorrect statement?
No, it's not. It's true. So, yeah, their safety, unnerving. Patient safety, adverse reactions, anything should have been captured. And while they're being placed in a hallway, nobody's monitoring them. Nobody's watching after them. There was no qualified staff there that could administer any kind of emergency medication. And speaking to that, when I started to look through our crash cart, our emergency medicines, a lot of them were expired. Mm. A lot of the emergency medications were not even there. So that was another finding that I had.
It's just staggering to hear this is, and this is the group that's supposed to be monitoring safety. It pains me to see how unsafe this all seems. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you bring it to them, and let's discuss the internal back and forth around this before we actually get into some of those logs that I think are really important to demonstrate just exactly what you were just saying. But let's discuss for a minute the back and forth on their on the text messages, which I believe the green is you, correct?
The green is me. Yes.
And this is going back and forth about the follow-up after these concerns have been brought to the table. As you can see posting here, the things you're already referencing, 30-minute post-vaccination observation time. Observation time is frequently longer than it should be. Visits conducted, violations of HIPAA, and so on. So this is after you've brought the concerns to the table. Right.
So go back to that really quickly, okay. Ryan, because that was less than 30 minutes.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Frequency less than 30 minutes. Please.
That's okay. I always get those confused too. But yeah, so on the 17th, it was my recommendation that they immediately pause or stop enrollment into the trial until we were able to, catch up. The data was behind. Pfizer and ICON were frequently asking for, you know, patients' information to be updated. So this call here, or this text message conversation was after
one
that you're looking at.
Okay, got it.
Was after my call with the leadership team, and they said, okay, let's take a pause. Let's figure out, you know, about hiring more staff. Maybe a backup principal investigator, a sub-investigator rather, and get back on track.
Mm-hmm. Which clearly suggests there that they're aware there's a problem. And as it's not, I'll wait to say that in regard to the amount of people. So continuing down, let me know if you want me to stop anywhere that I'm skipping past. I think this is the part that really stands out, as we've talked about in the past. is the acknowledgement, one, that there is clearly a problem, less sort of undefined on this conversation, but two, that we're going to lie about that problem and call it something other than it is. Right. So go ahead and tell us what we're seeing here.
So the relationship with Ventavia and with Pfizer was definitely stood out to me. The person that they're talking about here, I don't know if his name is, where is Arturo's name?
Rayer, yeah.
Oh yeah, there it is. So Arturo Alfaro was the site representative that worked with Pfizer and the site directly. So he was kind of the person or the representative we would go to if we had a protocol related question. He, a lot of times, was driving the push for enrolling more participants in the study, even though he knew and was calling for Ventavia to enter the data so that they were able to see it. But this particular text message here is the managing members, Christy Rainey, myself, the other managing member, Olivia, discussing what they wanted to tell Pfizer in regards to pausing or stopping enrollment. So you can see Christy's, you know, basically saying, let's pretend or make it like it's no big deal. We don't want Pfizer to know, I guess, how things were going.
Mm-hmm. And you can see up here as well, this person's, Christie's before, is saying, wait, who said anything about running out of supplies? Because, you know, this is the conversation being had about whether it should be about anything other than safety problems, right?
Yeah. So Mercedes Livingston, I believe, is the one who said, well, let's just tell everybody that we ran out of supplies. That's why we want to stop enrollment. Yeah, it's right there.
Yep.
And so I'm like, we don't need to say that, because then it makes it appear, if we tell everybody that we've run out of supplies, that we're you know, Pfizer is not prepared or we're not prepared, which we were not, but I didn't understand why she would want to lie about that.
Right. Now, the next part here, actually, well, this, and what I found interesting, by the way, is maybe you can give me your thoughts on why this, I mean, I think it's clear, is that one, they more than once point out that this is something that they're reiterating this part later in the conversation. So this is 10:49 in the morning. Later here at 2:19, they reiterate it again and put here, if Arturo questions us, here's what we say. So it just kind of, again, makes it even more clear that this is creating the narrative, not necessarily what's actually happening. I just wanted to point that out. I thought that was quite interesting. Yeah. And then to finish off here, on this, unless you have other points in this conversation, as it says here, don't cancel anyone on their way. So people that are already in the process of going to the trial that might piss them off, and they can call the news. So what does that mean?
They were very concerned with, you know, customer and patient satisfaction. We actually, if a patient, there's actually, I have an email from a participant who was upset because they were left in an exam room for a very long time. She felt like that Ventavia had forgotten about her, and in order to not, you know, make her upset and have her potentially contact the news or the FDA for that matter, we were instructed to make sure that these people that were upset were happy when they left by giving them additional payments in the form of gift cards to restaurants, Starbucks, for example. So anything that they could do to I guess, not be told on, they were willing to.
I'm not one to, that is beyond, that is a bribe.
I mean, there's
no way to call it anything else. There's a problem they recognize. They don't want them to talk about that problem, so they give them financial incentives. You know, and that's just, again, overflowing with examples of dishonesty. And even if you want to try to frame this as some sort of a, you know, doing the wrong thing for the right reasons, it doesn't change the fact that this is being overshadowed, covered up, not allowed to be talked about. And it just speaks volumes.
Yeah. It is a regulatory violation to, you know, coerce participants and give them any financial incentive outside of what they receive for their participation and time and travel in the actual clinical trial.
Oh, so that's actually a crime in the context of this. That's, you know, see, these are things that people need to continue to flesh out. because this is happening, and it's important that people understand that it's not in the best interest of the individual out there that is continuing to ask for these people to keep them safe, if you still believe that's what's happening. But let's jump into the next part here that I think is a really, really telling one. This is one that was focused on by Thacker and with the Pfizer Gate documentary, the Italian one, a really big focal point on that. I think this is one of the most important ones. So you go, if you want me to talk about it, if you'd like to just jump in and explain what we're looking at here.
Sure, I'll give my voice a little rest, Ryan. Go ahead.
Okay. So as I understand it, what we're looking at here is a laboratory sample processing log. And I'll let you explain the meanings of these different slots here. But what this is the process of the blood samples and the timings of the different processes that they go through. Now, what you'll notice is that there, and I'll let Brooke speak to what they're supposed to be, that there's discrepancies here, specifically on this one main page that we'll focus on, but there's an entire log we can look through. And what you'll find as you go through this is that, first of all, numbers being perfectly synchronized to 30 exactly every single time is almost didn't happen. And you'll prove that by the other data. But what this ultimately shows you is that the people are either lying about what happened or being so lax about what they're doing that they're not filling it out, and they circle back later and just 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, because that's what's expected. So give me your thoughts.
And I think a lot of it had to do with just training, lack of experience in conducting clinical trials. For this particular document that we're looking here now, the 30-minute clock time was one thing that stood out to me right away as an auditor of clinical trials. Good documentation.
Do me a favor, before we jump into each one of them, give the audience a quick understanding of what these are, what the time, the clot time column means, the centrifuge and so on, so they understand what the process is, and then let's get into what they mean.
Sure. So the sample processing log is documentation of, and for this particular example, it's of the blood draw that was done as part of the protocol that was required of the protocol. It establishes a baseline. So visit one establishes that baseline for the participant prior to them getting their injection. So the draw time obviously is the time and date in which the blood draw was taken or the sample was taken. Per the protocol, there is a minimum clock time of 30 minutes. So once you collect the specimen in the vacutainer, it's inverted 5 times and then left alone to clot for 30 minutes. After that 30 minutes and up to 2 hours, and this is all per the protocol, up to 2 hours, again, it's left to clot. And at that point, it is put into the centrifuge, which separates the serum from the plasma.
As it says, at least 15 minutes.
For at least 15 minutes. And I believe actually that speed is actually too high. There was one centrifuge in the clinic. And that's why I know a lot of this data is inaccurate, because of how many patients they were seeing in a day, and based on the time and such, it just doesn't make sense.
It's impossible, right?
It is impossible, yes. So once it's centrifuged for at least 15 minutes, then the serum from the top of that process is aliquoted into a transfer tube. And at that point, that transfer tube with the serum is placed in the freezer and then shipped.
Okay. So,
the process.
So as I understand it, so V1, the visit one, they take the time that they take, they draw the blood. They have to allow it to clot for at least 15 minutes, or excuse me, at least 30 minutes, right? Okay. At least, right. Minimum. And then it has to be at least 15 minutes in the centrifuge, and then they mark down the time of aliquoting. Now, what's interesting here is that the point that she's making here is that, one, based on the limited resources, it's literally impossible for them to have done this in the appropriate amount of time for each of them, which is in and of itself verifiable. But then we have the interesting point that you showed me, Brooke, which is the 30, 30, 30, 30. So why did that stand out to you that they're all 30?
Well, because of just Ventavia's process, the number of patients that they were seeing in a day, it was just not organized. There wasn't a timer in the lab at the point in which I was looking, so it was just impossible to have, you know, it timed so precisely that you would have an exact clot time.
Right. And that it would be 30 exactly every single time. But then to the best point that you made clear when we talked about this last is that if you actually just look at the date and time and then compare that to the time in the centrifuge, you'll quickly find out that the 30 minute number they wrote is actually not even what it adds up to.
And it doesn't. No. So other than, you know, the 30 minute clot time all the way down for every single participant. Another thing that stood out to me was the good documentation practice or good clinical practice in the cross out of the scratch out of the actual times in certain places. So in clinical research, and this one's actually, it's not a great example, but if there is an error, it's like a contract. So if there is an error, it's one line through, initial and date and the correct information visible. So a lot of times the laboratory or phlebotomist that was doing the processing of the samples would just scratch out the time. So you couldn't, it's not verifiable.
And I think what this, like one thing that I asked before in our pre-interviews discussion was that, you know, what does this ultimately mean? From the blood processing perspective, does this invalidate those results? Like hypothetically, if it had clotted longer or less than it should have, or it spent too much time in the centrifuge, would that, or too little, would that invalidate these samples?
You know, that's a great question and a little beyond my scope. I know in previous studies, depending on the circumstance and time, sometimes it did invalidate, you know, and the actual sample. But again, that's not something that Pfizer shared. I'm not sure whether or not this data can even be trusted. I mean, it can't be trusted. It's obviously
exactly. Exactly. It speaks to the fact to the lackadaisical nature of everything that they're doing, and that they're not following procedure, that they're filling these things in after the fact. Even if in the way they're trying to frame this, this does not directly influence the data, or however they're trying to claim it, it puts the question out there that these questions should be asked. Why were they not following procedure? Could that have affected the safety of the data that they're using, or the safety of the trial? Of course, those are possibles. Yet nobody cares to ask these questions other than you and the people following up on your research.
Yeah, I'm looking at that very last example at the draw time of 12:43. Mm-hmm. And then scroll back out, Ryan, a little bit. Sorry. Yeah, so it's put into the centrifuge at 13:40. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be in there for 15 minutes. And 2 minutes later, they take it out.
Right. I mean, I'm not an expert in this field, but I think that's obviously not what's supposed to happen. I think that would at the very least make it questionable that this would end up being what they would need from it. I mean, there's a reason that it says at least 15 minutes. I don't know what that reason is, but the reason is that this is how you get the sample the way that they would want it. So it's amazing to me that we have this much evidence that, and it's not like we're breaking this for the first time on the show. This has been out since November 2nd. Or at the very least, the data was reviewed by the British Medical Journal and was backed up by their clout and put out in their article. And it's been followed up by Thacker long since this moment. And it's amazing that none of the mainstream corporate media are willing to discuss this.
Ryan, Pfizer has known about this since the 26th of September. They should have known about it before if they were following their monitoring plan or going to the site and actually verifying the data. They failed to do that. And which in my mind makes them, you know, complicit in everything that Ventavia has done. Icon and Pfizer failed to follow up. They failed to do what they were supposed to do. because if they would have come into the site and looked at that, they certainly would have, I hope, would have made it right.
Well, here's an interesting thing to point out is that in all the follow-up coverage from Pfizer and anybody else and their statements put out about this, no, they're not claiming, well, yes, those were there, but it doesn't indicate a problem. They're just going, nothing is a problem. They're literally pretending like what we just showed you doesn't exist. That's quite a different discussion than to say, yes, that's there. However, we in our research, it shows that we're not concerned about it. That's a very different statement, you know? So it just, this is where we are in this discussion about all this stuff, whether in the context of the trial that you're involved in or the broader discussion, is that there's an active effort here to not acknowledge things that undermine whatever's happening right now. And that's alarming to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you're really divulging here to people, showing people is that this is something that stems all the way back to the trial and the information that was in that. Now, if we want to jump in next to the followed up discussion of emails where this is absolutely something that they're acknowledging as a problem, as they say in this email, the cleanup call, right? The idea that they're actually having a call to discuss cleaning up the problem. And you just saw the text messages where they acknowledge they're going to call it something else. Want to speak on that for me?
Yeah. So after the 17th, when they, you know, decided to pause enrollment and lie about the reasons why they did that, everybody, it was all hands on deck at that point. They were calling in family members and friends to come in and make sure that all of those randomization schemes were out of the charts, that, you know, every chart was looked at. We were told to, you know, just go through everyone, make sure nothing's there. Let's get it cleaned up. And I will never forget the first time that I met the principal investigator. It was on day four, Mark Cook. He told me personally that we needed to get this shit cleaned up before we started any new clinical trials. So even he was aware of the problems that were going on, and just how big of a scale the problem really was. So after the 17th, again, all hands on deck, we were bringing in people to every single one of the locations. And at that point, you know, going through all of the three different sites, close to, I mean, it was over 1,000 charts that we were supposed to go through. As we were doing this from the 17th through, I believe, what was this, on the 21st, right? Yeah, the 21st.
Yeah.
We were kind of keeping a spreadsheet or tracking what the most common findings were. This was everybody. This was, you know, William Jones, who was the director of QC, quality control, quality assurance, the managing members. Mercedes was the CEO or COO. Sorry, she was in on the chart reviews. Everybody on staff was looking through these charts. So on the 21st, we were invited to a call to discuss the most common findings in the charts that we had been able to review from the 17th through the 21st. Mm-hmm. I did not accept this call because I knew at that point that I kind of just thrown my hands up. I was not going to be involved in the type of cleanup that Ventavia wanted to do. And that was, you know, hide things, cover them up, make them right. If data was missing, they were falsifying, they were fabricating data.
Right.
And they still do that today, actually.
I think, again, that it speaks to the continuity of this from before documenting that it was happening and not at that point arguing that we should do something about it, rather just dealing, fix your e-diaries is what this was saying back then, right? It's the same kind of thing now. Let's find these problems, fill in 30, 30, 30, 30, right? Let's fix that's solving that problem in their mind. And that's not safe. That's not following procedure. That's not in any way appropriate to what we're talking about today. Now, this is what I was referencing before, and all this will be included for you guys to look at for yourselves, the list off of the most common problems, and it lists off all the things that we've continued to talk about.
Yeah, I think this, excuse me, from the call on the 21st, they put together this most common checklist. So from the 24th forward, this was kind of to be used when looking through every chart. And since these were the most common findings, just going through that chart and looking right away for these common these common problems.
So again, trying to find these and as opposed to dealing with them, it seems just to, like, if you can have a checklist for these kind of problems to make it that common, that's a little bit unnerving for somebody testing the safety, right? I mean, that speaks for itself.
Yeah. And just going through, you know, that first little section there, informed consent, it was just happening. There was no process. It was just here, sign here, date here. And let's get you the vaccine and in and out of, you know, the clinic so we can move the next people through. That was actually something else that I found too, was they were canceling visits for single people that were interested in doing the study so that they could move in patients that were coming with maybe their spouse, for example. So instead of just consenting one person, they were able to, you know, bring that husband and wife, for example, into the same exam room together so that they could, you know, see two instead of one. Another thing.
I imagine that's not procedure, right? I mean, am I incorrect in saying that?
Well, it was just how, you know, I mean, they weren't concerned with, you know, furthering medicine and it was all about money and seeing two at one time versus, you know, one was just more money for Ventavia.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to some of this next documentation on September 22nd, mm-hmm. where it discusses, and there's a couple mm-hmm. of these we'll show in a line here, which it shows you that not only are they aware of this, that they're actively talking about making sure we call it something else, but that they're actually making sure that they deal with these, or at least as it says here, we'll be having a 1-hour mandatory training on Thursday to discuss some common findings we found in our current Pfizer COVID study on all three of our sites, mm-hmm. which seems to back up mm-hmm. what you were saying. You have any thoughts on that before I go to the next one?
Yeah, this was more about the documentation practices. We call it Alcoa. You know, if there's an error, make sure that the data is attributable, that, you know, one line through initial and dating. So this was company-wide. This was a training that they wanted to do mainly to talk about good documentation, good clinical practice in the charts. Mm-hmm.
And then the next one, which I think is more clear, and again on the 22nd, yesterday's meeting was really good. It says, we know we have a problem and we are working as a team to start getting it fixed. I think that's just relevant to point out again, that they're acknowledging openly in internal conversation that there's clearly a problem. And I would imagine that the American people and the people taking these injections that are being called safe by this data would want to know that, right? I mean, I think that's about transparency.
Sure. I would want to know.
And this is the same email. I just want to make sure people see that we have this included in the show notes in regard to both Paul Thacker's documentation as well as the stuff that I will have on The Last American Vagabond for you guys to check out. Now, finally, and we can go from here and talk about anything else that you think might be relevant to wrap up today. I want people to see that since all of this, this is the date of review for 11/23/2020. So November 23rd, 2020. And it goes on to list the findings of pretty much everything that Brooke pointed out: informed consent, chart order, eligibility, even in regard to up here in regard to space and facilities, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it just blows my mind. So how can they stand at a point now and argue that this stuff is inaccurate when even a summary found the same things?
Yeah, and this is some of the documents that are new that I've seen recently. Because this happened obviously after I was gone. I left or was fired in September. This was from November. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is. It's definitely concerning, and I just don't understand why the FDA has not gone in and shut down this site. It just is shocking, and I have put, you know, I guess just a lot of faith in the clinical trial process. And I believe that my phone call was to the FDA was credible and enough. I spoke to an investigator for over an hour on the 29th of September, a few days after I filed my initial complaint. And I went over my concerns with Investigator Cannon in detail. So she knew, about the problems. And I think it's important too to point out that this is not just happening in the Pfizer study. They are doing other clinical trials too on COVID vaccines. You know, we can maybe in the next conversation get into that based on the leaked documents. I can certainly speak to those because I was there when some of those were happening as well, but it's scary.
Yeah, no, and I absolutely plan on having us connect again and dive in deeper to a lot of this stuff, because this is some very important stuff that is being actively hidden. And I think the important part about today was just to lay this out there. Even, I mean, there's so much information, there's so much included here that there's a lot of it is just there for you guys to look at for yourselves in regard to the FDA's investigation of in how they conducted this, or the information around how they knew the FDA was coming. And there's a lot of points to this that we didn't necessarily get into today, but we will follow up on this and talk deeper into it. But the reality is that everything she's told you so far, everything the British Medical Journal vetted extensively, everything that Thacker vetted extensively, all of that is easy to verify. And right now, in real time, they're standing over that information and going, don't look at it, she's lying. And it's just incredible to me that this is even somewhere where we find ourselves in this society where you are choosing to take the word of somebody who has been caught. Well, I don't even want to just pinpoint Pfizer. At the end of the day, in a situation where, in an authority situation in the world today, that we're willing to take at face value what they say while we have the documents in front of us. It just speaks to the problem we're in a larger sense in today's society. Right. So. Yeah, I
would
just
speaking to those that think that, you know, this is just, you know, maybe three sites. This study has been done, you know, in total at 153 sites. What makes you think that? My question is, if it happened at Batavia, where else did it happen? And for the FDA to only, you know, look at 9 clinical trial sites in this so important, you know, pivotal trial, I'm concerned that the speed in which, you know, Pfizer was pushing and their race to be number one, that there's more to see, and it's not just at Batavia. And so that's really my call, is for, you know, more clinical trial oversight.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that the important thing to remember is that data, this very data that you're pointing to, was what was used to justify the emergency use authorization, to justify what's going forward. And that should be concerning at the very least. So thank you for being here and having the courage to speak on this, Brooke. I really
think
it's my pleasure. And I think it's one of the most important things happening right now. So I look forward to connecting again and diving deeper into this. And hopefully everybody out there can continue to dive into this information, get it out in front of people that don't know about it because they're not looking anywhere other than mainstream media that's refusing to talk about this information. So thank you for being here, Brooke. And as always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.